On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's hard conversation on immigration tends to focus on illegal desert border crossings and low-paid, low-skilled workers. But there's another end of the immigration debate. Highly educated, high-skilled, largely high-tech workers from abroad that American industry says it desperately needs to compete. Tens of thousands already come every year. Business says it needs more of the planet's best and brightest. Opponents say the program is abused, and the U.S. should educate and pay its own high-tech talent. Up next on Point, the high end of the immigration debate over highly skilled workers and who should be welcomed to the USA. Joining me first today from New York is Peter Elstrom at Business Week Online. He's been following the high-tier talent visa debate. Peter Elstrom, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
So first, the basics. A H-1B visa, what is it? What's it intended for? How many are issued every year? What's it look like, Peter?
Well, the H-1B visa is designed to allow skilled workers from other countries to come to the U.S. and work in American business. Typically, these would be people with skills that are rare here in the U.S. So these could be engineers in a particularly obscure niche of software. They could be computer programmers, the kinds of people that companies here in the U.S. are having a hard time finding and hiring here, so they want to go outside and bring them to the U.S.
So we've got a lot of interest in this, and it's very interesting to look at exactly who's interested. We'll come to that. But every year they open up the gates for applications to bring people from abroad, we just saw this last week, an incredible rush to get those applications in to try and snatch up foreign talent. Tell us about that rush.
Yeah, there's a cap right now of 65,000 H-1B visas in the most kind of broad category. There are a couple other exceptions to it. And tech companies have been making the case that 65,000 is not nearly enough, that they need more of these workers to be able to come to the U.S., and they make the case that it's good for the U.S. economy for these kinds of workers to be able to come here because they help make American business more competitive, faster moving, more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. So they would like to see that cap raised. Under one proposal that was just introduced in the House a couple weeks ago, the Flake-Gutierrez bill, they would raise that cap from 65,000 to 115,000. And in addition to that, you would get a whole bunch more exceptions for people, for example, who graduate from an American university, who are from another country, but graduate from American university with a master's degree or a PhD in certain kinds of categories, such as computer science or electrical engineering.
Now, that cap, 65,000, they take applications for that. And we were just struck by last week, I believe, within one day, they had 150,000 applications once they opened the gates for this thing. I mean, people just jamming in here harder and faster and in higher volume, begging for these than ever before.
Yeah, this has been an increasing process in recent years where more and more applications have flooded in for the H-1B visas, and you're exactly right. This year, there were 150,000 applications in, I think it was a day and a half. So clearly more than we're going to be able to be accepted. So they accepted $150,000. They closed the doors, and now they're going to have a lottery to determine which of those 150,000 people get the 65,000 visas. So there's been a lot of criticism of that. Is that the best way to allocate these visas, to do it essentially based on a lottery as opposed to perhaps the people who are going to add the most value to the U.S. economy?
Really assessing individual need, but there's a lot more here. Bill Gates, chairman of Microsoft, saying within the last month that U.S. industry, high tech, absolutely needs these. And as you say, Representative Luis Gutierrez of Illinois, Democrat, and Jeff Flake, Republican, Arizona, proposing an increase that would go from 65 to 115, ultimately to 180,000 of these visas a year. Of course, they're good for 3 years. They can be re-upped to 6 years that they can stay in the country. But you've got another bill from Senators Dick Durbin, Illinois, and Charles Grassley, Iowa, that would clamp down here. You've been looking, as have others, at how these visas actually get used, and some kind of surprising results there, Peter, in who's lining up most aggressively to snag these workers from abroad. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is the fact that the companies that end up using these H-1B visas are not always the companies that you would expect. Now, the government makes available the applications from the company. It does not disclose publicly who actually gets these H-1B visas,
right,
which is a very controversial point, by the way, that they don't have transparency on this.
Yeah,
but
strange.
What we know is that the companies that are the most active applicants for these visas are outsourcing companies. In many cases, they're Indian outsourcing companies, but they're also what we think of as U.S. companies, including Accenture.
Outsourcing companies, in other words, companies that take a work and do it abroad instead of here, offshoring. But why would they want to import talent if their goal is to get talent, I mean, get work done in India, let's say?
Well, some of these companies will talk about it. In fact, one of the Indian outsourcers that I talked to described how they use H-1B visas in order to bring in workers from India to work in the U.S. for 2 or 3 years to understand American business, to understand how to interact with their customers. And many of these customers are the biggest American companies. And then these Indian workers go back to India where they're able to perform essentially the same functions that they were doing in the U.S. Much more effectively, much more efficiently.
So this is where it gets kind of mind-boggling. We're told we need to bring them here for the U.S. to compete more effectively. But if you look last year, out of 100,000-plus applications, 22,000 from Infosys Technologies, an Indian company, 19,000 from Wipro, an Indian company, number three on that list, an Indian company. Companies actually using this to turn around and send American jobs abroad.
Right. That's the big concern here, in that the current criteria for the H-1B visas, in fact, facilitate even the outsourcing of American jobs. That's the big concern, and that's what Senators Durbin and Grassley are certainly looking into when they look at some of these criteria. And I think on the House side, you're also having some people look at exactly who's getting these visas and what they're using them for. So the big concern is, are these temporary work visas being used to facilitate outsourcing?
So here's the high-tech, the high-skill end of the immigration debate. Peter Elstrom at Businessweek Online in New York. Thanks a lot for taking us in here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Let me turn to Washington now and Lynn Shotwell. She's executive director of the American Council on International Personnel, represents more than 200 U.S. corporations. She lobbies to raise the cap on the number of visa for high-skilled workers from abroad. Lynn, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So what's the case you make for bringing in more immigrants on visa to do high-tech work in the U.S.?
Well, you know, American employers are in a global race to attract and retain the talent they need to develop new products and to provide the services that are in demand in today's economy. And this is not unique to the United States. None of the developed economies are producing enough domestic workers with the necessary math and science skills for the 21st century economy. Now, we've been fortunate in the United States that our immigration system has helped us attract not just talented students to the United States, but to keep those foreign students in the United States working and benefiting our economy.
For many years, for a long time now.
For many years. We've had a version of the H-1B visa in our laws since the 1950s. But this is the first time we find ourselves in a very strange situation where employers who've been planning for 10 months to hire people, who've done their best to plan ahead and determine who they need to have on the payroll, now face a situation where they are in a lottery where they have less than a 50% chance to be able to retain the worker that they need. And if for
to,
many
to
of
retain
workers,
or to hire in the first place?
To hire or to retain.
Okay.
In some cases, they have students that graduated from U.S. universities last year who were able to work for a year on their student visa but now need an H-1B. If that worker doesn't currently win the lottery, they'll have no choice but to go overseas.
We've got a country of 300 million, richest country in the world. Can it really be true that with that size of a nation and our splendid university system, we can't educate enough engineers, scientists, computer programmers to do the work that needs being done here?
Well, it's certainly a challenge, and we need to be working on both fronts. We need to, companies are putting billions of dollars into efforts to improve our K-12 education system, to make sure that we have the homegrown talent that we need. But if you look at the data at who's coming out of U.S. universities, over half of the people graduating from U.S. universities with advanced degrees in the maths and sciences are foreign nationals. For example, in Massachusetts, a third of engineering master's degrees go to foreign nationals, and half of the PhDs in engineering go to foreign nationals. So we're putting ourselves in a situation where we're telling American companies recruiting at American universities that they can't access half that graduating class.
But what about this case that you've got Indian companies whose whole business is taking American jobs abroad, first in line here with vast numbers of applications, presumably in a lottery? They're getting a lot of those. They're importing talent from India to come over, learn how companies work, and actually take lots of jobs back with them offshore.
We're in a global economy, and the Indian companies are, in fact, bringing H-1B workers to the United States. But I think that helps retain some jobs here.
Really? I mean, their business is taking jobs abroad. You might retain some, but how many are lost in that dynamic?
You know, making H-1B visas unavailable doesn't change the dynamics of the global economy.
We're joined right now from Richmond, Virginia, by Ron Hira. He's professor of public policy at Rochester Institute of Technology and a research associate with the Economic Policy Institute. Their 19-person board includes 8 union presidents. Ron Hira, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So you're the guy who crunched the numbers and said, hey, wait a minute, a huge portion of these applications for visas to bring in top talent are being used to bring in representatives of Indian companies whose business is to take this offshore. Is this working? How do you look at it overall, Ron?
No, I think the H-1B program is deeply flawed in a number of respects. One respect is in the way that it's being used to outsource jobs. And let me point out, it's not just Indian companies. It's lots of companies that have outsourcing as their business model, whether it's an Accenture, a Deloitte, or homegrown names like IBM.
So American companies, too, you're saying, involved in that offshoring. Sure. But the top three, as I read the report here, Indian and American right behind.
Well, I think the third one is Cognizant, which is actually a U.S.-based company that has essentially the same business model as Infosys. Mm-hmm. So I don't make that distinction between an American company and an Indian company. Mm-hmm. It's a question of how the companies are actually using the H-1B program. And there's also additional problems with the program that's been deeply flawed, that government report after government report has pointed out, including the president's own Office of Management and Budget. And OMB is the management arm of the president, and they've said that it's got serious flaws that leave it vulnerable to fraud and abuse, sorry, go ahead.
No, just so we understand it may need tweaking, maybe significant tweaking, but let me get you on the fundamental point that Bill Gates at Microsoft and others make, saying, look, it's a global economy. We need the best talent on the planet, the best and the brightest. Don't choke off this flow. This is what the United States is going to need to remain competitive in a flat earth world, as Tom Friedman calls it. What do you say to that, Ron?
Well, I think that there's almost universal agreement that we should encourage the best and brightest to stay here and to immigrate. But the key is that they should come in as immigrants, not as guest workers, not as non-immigrants. And the H-1B program is not the way to do it. The best way to do that is to fix the green card system and think through how we encourage those best and brightest to be here. So there's no argument about the best and brightest, and there's no argument about trying to attract $100,000 a year software engineers. The issue is with the H-1B program, the median wage is $50,000, which means that essentially half of the people that are coming in and as computer professionals are being paid below $50,000, which is below the entry-level wage for a bachelor's degree.
Lynn Shotwell, how about it? Great. Let's bring them if they want to come, and American companies need them, but have them get in line for full immigration, not for 3 or 6 years of temporary guest worker status, as Ron puts it.
You know, I couldn't agree more with Ron that what we should be doing is giving green cards to the workers that we want to keep. Unfortunately, our green card system is also backlogged, so that right now an Indian national can't get a green card unless they applied for they started the process to get one back in around 1998. That's just a flawed system. So what we've been doing is using the H-1B as somewhat of a holding pen until we can get people through the green card system. We'd love to see that reformed. And then that way the H-1B program could return back to its original intent, which was as a temporary worker program to help companies with their global operations.
So you want to be at the top in global competition, yet we don't want to see jobs just flowing abroad. Lynn Shotwell and Ron Hira, please stand by. I want to bring our listeners in. Richard's calling from Bluffton, South Carolina. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you know, Richard?
Well, it seems to me that Given the history of the dot-com boom and the bust and the amount of people that highly skilled people, and I'm not in that field, that seemed to go under, couldn't find employment or underemployed, and it seems to me that there's not only a glut of talent, at least that's what I've heard over the years, in this country, but there are people coming out of school that are American. And I'm fully aware of the fact that we're in a global economy, but I believe that there are certain fields, and tech being one of them, that down the road, our economic development and questions of national security are in the mix. And I think it's very foolish to bring people in that can take, in many cases, what I would imagine would wind up being proprietary information abroad.
So surely we can man and woman those posts from home, and yet immigrants have played a big role for a long time in pushing the American high-tech frontier. But, Richard, let us pick that up. To look at that, let's turn to another voice, another guest from Washington here. I've got Robert Hoffman with us. He's vice president of Oracle Corporation, huge in the high-tech world. He's been a vocal advocate in Washington for raising the cap on the number of visas for high-skilled workers. He's co-chair of a group called Compete America. That's a coalition of business corporations, research institutions, trade associations that want more imported talent available to U.S. companies. Robert Hoffman, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. You heard our caller right there from Bluffton saying, surely in a country this size, we can raise up the talent that we need and by that keep proprietary information and jobs and good-paying jobs here in the country. What do you say to that from the Oracle spot, Robert Hoffman?
Well, certainly I couldn't agree with him more. I think we do need to work on making math and science cool and building up our homegrown talent. That is a long-term proposition and one that many companies, not just Oracle, but Microsoft, Intel, HP, are spending a lot of their resources trying to do. And interestingly, $1,500 out of every H-1B visa that's issued goes toward math and science education, whether it be in the form of scholarships or job training to uplift that. But there are certain
It's a nice token, but it's just a token. I mean, in the national, it's a not less than
a drop
in the bucket, right?
Since that $1,500 set aside, it wasn't $1,500, it was $1,000 per visa. Since that was set aside, that's been over $1 billion, and that's not counting the hundreds of millions of dollars that flow from each company toward education and job training programs to try to uplift our homegrown talent. But the one statistic that you really can't ignore is the fact that we have over 560,000 international students, mostly from India, China, and Korea, enrolled in U.S. colleges and universities here in the United States. So we're not just talking about trying to attract people from overseas, but we're also talking about trying to attract people who have been educated in this country, in a lot of cases with U.S. taxpayer dollars, trying to keep them, trying to now that they've gotten this great education in the United States, a world-class education in the United States, what the H-1B program is about, as Lynn pointed out, is trying to find a way to capture them and give them a path to a green card after receiving this top-flight U.S. education in the United States.
But talk to us about what seems like the heart of this, Robert. If you're importing lots, I mean, and God love them, they come, they study here, they learn a lot, many on the frontier. Great to put them to work for the U.S. economy, but what about U.S. workers? And what about wages? $50,000 median wage for these H-1B visas, that doesn't sound like, it sounds like they could very well be undercutting American high-tech workers.
Well, I think that the statistics are pretty clear, especially the statistics that were released last week, which shows that with respect to software engineers, we're looking at an unemployment rate of 1.7%. For IT overall, we're looking at unemployment at about 2.2%. Now, the OECD rates that full employment is somewhere between 4 to 6.4%.
Right.
So in the software and the IT industry, we're at under full employment, which suggests that we have shortages of workers. In addition, Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates cited Bureau of Labor Statistics studies that show that we're creating 100,000 new jobs every year between now and 2014, and we need to fill these jobs. And when you have more than half of graduates in master's and PhDs coming out of U.S. colleges and universities who are foreign-born, you're talking about a talent pool that is significantly foreign-born. We have a choice. We could either recruit and retain these people along with American workers, or we can let them go overseas and the jobs go with them. And I think that's the real fundamental point. We don't see this as an either-or proposition. And also, the important point to note is the H-1B program and the green card program that comes along with it when it comes to skilled talent, this isn't about filling jobs. This is about jobs that create jobs. This is about trying to ensure that we have the innovation, the intellectual, the knowledge base to grow our economy. The interesting point is we're operating under a 1990 immigration law. We are here in 2007 operating under a 1990 immigration structure that was put in place before the internet economy, before nanotechnology, biotech, green tech, all of these technology industries that are on the cusp of booming.
But what if these jobs are being... it's an old program, we get it, but what if the jobs that are created are actually created overseas? This huge number of applications for H-1B visas from companies that are in India or elsewhere, or American companies looking to facilitate the movement of jobs out.
Well, I can only speak for Oracle, and more than 90% of our H-1B holders are trying to get a green card. And as Lynn pointed out earlier, we have an enormous backlog of green cards. So we not only need to fix the H-1B program, but we also need to fix the green card program. And frankly, we need to fix both. I mean, it'd be kind of like saying, you know, you support landing on the moon, but not support funding the rockets to get you there. We need to look at it in that kind of a context. For all practical purposes, the H-1B program for us, for HP, for all the companies that are pushing this agenda for Compete America, it has to be both. You can't fix one without fixing the other.
Ron Hira, how about it? Bill Gates says he feels deep anxiety about America's capacity to compete, and this flow of talent from abroad is one of the legs of this tool, he says, is key to making that happen. You may think it doesn't work well, but without it, where are people going to be? Or if the cap isn't raised to meet the kind of demand that Oracle's talking about here?
Well, let me address a couple of – let me address that, but let me address a few misleading statistics that were just cited. First, Robert represents Compete America, and Wipro, one of the companies you mentioned, the outsourcing company, is part of that coalition, part of the Compete America coalition. So he is speaking, in fact, for those outsourcing companies, whether he realizes it or not. But let me address this 2.2% unemployment statistic, which is highly misleading.
In software, with computer programming, I believe?
Right, in IT occupations.
Okay.
It's actually above the general unemployment rate for professional occupations. You can't compare it against the overall unemployment rate. That would be a misleading way of comparing statistics because the overall unemployment rate includes people that are high school dropouts, teenagers, and so on and so forth. So what you really want to do is look at a peer group. And in fact, IT occupations are much higher unemployment rate than, let's say, social scientists. So to use that statistic, it doesn't make much sense. What you really want to do is look at salaries, which basically have been flat. Salaries give you a sense of what the demand is. Then he also quotes this 100,000 new jobs from the BLS. Well, that's actually just a forecast. That's a BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, forecasts how many jobs they believe might be created over 10 years. That's not destiny. And in fact, that statistic or those forecasts have been highly unreliable. In fact, if we believed that they were destiny as Robert is using them, then we'd have a million more jobs in IT today than we do. So what happened to the forecast from before? They were way wrong. So to use that as destiny is absolutely misleading.
Let me just break in for a moment. I mean, there's the debate in a nutshell. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to get a response there and hear more from you, Ron, but let me get a caller from Newton, Massachusetts. Julian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Another great On Point show.
Thanks.
I'm a 1966 graduate of MIT who was laid off in 2003. And have been struggling to stay alive ever since. I'm deeply anxious about Bill Gates, if he's deeply anxious about the U.S. economy.
What's your field, Julian? Are you in computers?
I'm a programmer, and I've been a manager in the computer science area.
So you're out there from a top school. You're in a high-demand area. Why should you be unemployed for 3 or 4 years?
That's the question that I have. I had the fellow who replaced me and went to India call me one evening and tell me they had to learn to live at a lower standard.
In other words, if you want work, accept a lower salary.
That's right.
And you've refused to do that, and you've got no job.
I don't refuse to do that. I can barely get anybody to look at my resume as a result of my age. I want to know what happened to the older workers.
This is a brutal question, Julian, but are you behind the curve? You know, are they educating up a new tier that just knows stuff you don't?
I don't believe that's the case. I'm still doing consulting on a regular basis, and I think I can give you many references that will tell you I do excellent work.
Well, we got it, and we believe it. Robert Hoffman, let me put that to you. I know it's just one case, but there's a voice of, you know, a highly educated American worker can't find the job in exactly this arena.
Well, it is one case, and obviously that is one of the bigger questions, and we have to look at it from a macroeconomic standpoint as well as a microeconomic standpoint. But the fact of the matter is, for Oracle, we have job openings at Oracle. I would encourage the caller to look on our website and to see if there are opportunities that fit his skill set. That's not just true for Oracle, but true for a lot of companies. And I think that really what it boils down to from our vantage point is making sure that we have an available talent pool. And I know Ron pointed out, comparing the unemployment statistics, but still you can't, just look away at an unemployment rate of 2.2% overall for IT.
Right, we've got that. But let me ask you on the salary front. What the guy who replaced Julian said to him, you've got to settle for a lower standard of living. Now, the U.S. may need these workers to compete, but does it also come with that implication, Robert Hoffman, that American tech workers are going to have to take lower pay to stay in the game?
Well, the reality is that the H-1B program, and I know Ron will call this legalese, but the law is the law. We have to pay them either the prevailing wage or what we would offer that same salary to a worker regardless of their national origin, whichever is higher. So if there are issues of fraud, if there are issues of abuse, we pay $500 out of every visa toward anti-fraud programs.
But out of the detail, do you see downward pressure on American salaries?
That's $47 million a year for anti-fraud programs. And guess what? If you increase the number of H-1B visas, that's even more money toward anti-fraud. So
are you ducking the question of downward pressure on American tech incomes or not?
Well, I'm not ducking any question. The reality is you can't blame the H-1B program for putting downward pressure on wages.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Michael's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I love your show, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
So I have one main point, but I have a deep concern for something that you brought up earlier, that being that this H-1B system, so many of the H-1B jobs are going to Indian companies or other outsourcing companies from other countries as a purpose to gain knowledge on how we run business so they can better run their businesses or so they can run their businesses to outcompete us, I guess.
Well, so they come here, learn the business, and then facilitate jobs going overseas, but you're hearing American corporations saying, look, that's the way it is. It's a global economy, and if we have to compete from here or there, we have to compete. What do you say to that, Michael?
I certainly agree with there being a global economy. I work for a company, a high-tech company, that does the same thing. We have people coming here on H-1B visas as well from China, from Japan, from India. We have a need for their talent. The overall concern for me is what are we going to do here in the U.S. to keep the jobs here in the U.S.? When are we going? What I find out most often from these other people that come from other countries is that they are taught high-level math and science skills at a much earlier age than our kids are. I have a 10-year-old son.
Yeah.
I am driving to learn these things at an early age, but I'm one person. I can only do so much. When are we going to change the education system so that in the future we have these jobs?
It's American kids stepping up out of that $300 million. Michael, we got a lot of people who want in here, but we hear that loud and clear, and that is a giant question. We got 300 million people. Why can't we educate enough out of that to serve this demand for super top talent? I've got that on my list here. Let's go to Steve in Lexington, Massachusetts. Steve, what do you say?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I am a 30-year veteran of the software industry.
Yeah.
I've been personally subject to age discrimination, and I am nevertheless a strong advocate of opening our doors to foreign workers in
why?
The tech industry.
Why, Steve?
Because I believe it's incumbent upon us to compete. To answer the previous caller's question, the way that I think we can compete is to innovate more greatly than workers abroad. It is not solely to compete on the basis of excluding them from our shores.
But if the competition doesn't produce American jobs, is it a kind of a, empty bag for American citizens?
I think it will produce American jobs. I think to some extent American workers rest on our laurels because we feel entitled to those jobs,
mm-hmm.
when in fact global competition requires that we increase our skill level in relative to foreign competition, increase our innovation relative to foreign competition, and compete for high wages in that fashion rather than by excluding foreign workers who, by definition, are going to be paid less than us for equivalent work.
Right now, so get out there, get hungry, and use that talent for innovation that ultimately will serve everybody. You say, Steve, we've got that. Let me go to Boston and Kaylin. Kaylin, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. What do you think, Kaylin?
I am kind of looking at this from a more selfish perspective.
Okay.
And that is, I am in an evening MBA program right now, and
yep.
I'm in it with a bunch of people from all over the world. And I got to tell you, we're all workers during the day, and we come at night, and
mm-hmm.
it's so refreshing to have a different point of view. If we were all from just the Boston area, born and raised, it wouldn't be the same dynamic. And so having these people who are here from India and, I have a classmate from Thailand, all sorts of places.
So you like hanging out with the global village, and certainly we love that. That's always exciting. But what about the economic impact? What about the callers who say, they're taking my job at a wage I can't live on?
Well, I understand that. But, one of the benefits I see is by getting the education that's similar to the education that these people have, I'm making myself more available for those jobs because I am now at an equal playing field
right.
with these people.
So there's the upside. You're kind of getting in the global slipstream there, and good for you for doing that, Kaylin. All right, we've got a lot on the table here. Lynn, let me come to you first. Our caller in Cedar Rapids says, what is going on here long term? If we can't educate enough out of this population to serve American companies, we've got a problem here.
Well, we certainly have a great challenge. And, the immigration is just one piece of what the president is calling the American Competitiveness Initiative. We not only have to keep our doors open to the talent that we need, but we need to educate and train, our own children to do these jobs. And we also need to enhance our research and development funding, because there are many different reasons why a company will choose to locate to open a new facility or to locate a project in a particular place around the world. And, access to talent is just one of those reasons. They also look at other things like, can they get R&D funding? What are the taxes? So we have to start thinking about this in a holistic approach. But, I truly believe that our children are capable of learning, that we're capable of continuing to compete with the best of the world. I mean, we still lead the world in innovation. We have the best universities in the world, but we're being challenged. And we have to recognize that we can't sit back and rest on our laurels, but that we need to, work as hard as we can to stay ahead.
But, I think the suspicion in the back of some minds is that the companies you represent ultimately don't really care where the workers come from. I mean, it'd be nice if it were American. They'd have fewer political headwinds to face. But if they have to hire overseas, fine. And, if ultimately they do all their work overseas, fine.
I disagree. These are global companies, and certainly they a lot of their market is overseas, and so they do sell overseas, and they need to have operations where they're selling as well. But I
this
think
is more than operations. This is moving wholesale major corporate functions overseas. This isn't just call centers at this level.
It is. Companies are looking where they can do particular jobs most efficiently. And in some cases, that means moving an entire function overseas. But that doesn't mean that they're abandoning the United States altogether. We still see a great interest in American companies in developing research and in putting research and development centers in the United States and in keeping jobs here. But we have to recognize that, you know, in the same way that it used to be that companies from, you know, American companies would bid on outsourcing projects, now we have outsourcing projects being bid on from around the globe. Mm. And some of those jobs will move overseas.
Ron Hira, the other perspective we've just heard is, well, you know, even from inside the high-tech industry, our caller is saying, we've got to do this in order to stay at the front edge of innovation. Our caller who's in school with students from overseas saying, this is helping me, this companionship. I'm learning about the global competition right here, and you can imagine people even in workplaces saying that this is a positive. What do you say to it?
You've got to disentangle what's immigration, what's positive, and what may be detrimental. Mm. The question of having foreign students in graduate programs, I don't think is in any dispute. I mean, almost everybody supports that. I'm in a university. I'm a professor. I teach, and I've got foreign graduate students,
too. But a lot of people say they won't keep coming if they don't have that prospect of an American job at the end of their education.
Well, some will and some won't, but that's not the issue. The issue isn't whether they should have an opportunity to get an American job or not. The question really on the H-1B is not – this is a sort of a classic bait and switch. They've tried to frame the issue as being foreign graduate students that we want to keep here. In reality, what they're talking about – this is Lynn and Robert Hoffman – is they want a vastly expanded guest worker program. So it's really not just about these foreign graduate students who are getting squeezed out of the H-1B cap right now. I fully support the idea that we need to encourage the best and brightest to come and study here and encourage them to stay on, and we need a rational system for doing that. What I'm saying is the H-1B program doesn't actually achieve that. And let me give you a fact here.
Yo.
Wipro applied for 19,000 H-1B applications.
This is the Indian offshoring company, yeah.
Do you know how many green cards they applied for in the same year in FY06?
No,
fiscal
I don't.
Year 2069. 19,000 H-1Bs, 69 green cards.
Meaning they want to move them in and out, train them for offshoring, not to send people here. But we know that. That's their business. I mean, that's not a surprise, right?
That's right. But if the H-1B is the bridge to immigration towards a green card, we need a new bridge designer because not too many H-1Bs are getting to that green card finish line. Now, let me talk a little bit about this issue of education and K-12 education and whatnot. I mean, this is sort of motherhood and apple pie. Of course, everybody's for improving K-12 education. But if you look at the statistics, there's been about a 65-70% drop in computer science enrollment at the undergraduate level.
That doesn't sound like whatnot to me. That sounds like a potential crisis.
That's a 70% drop. It's a major crisis within universities for computer science professors who need enrollment, need people to come into their classes. Now, that drop over the last 4 years is not because our K-12 education system somehow collapsed in the last 4 years. It's because students are acting rationally. They don't see these as very good professions, these are as good occupations, and so they're shying away from it. It's not that we don't have the capacity to train people or we don't have the people here. The fact is that these students are making rational choices.
Foreign competition on visas not, here? Is that really the
because
reason?
Because the job market isn't particularly good, and part of what happens is when you have a student who's trying to decide what profession to go into, who do they talk to? They don't look and say, I'm going to be like Bill Gates and I'm going to listen to what Bill Gates says. They ask their family friends, they ask their uncles and aunts, and if those people are in that particular profession, many people in the IT profession are saying, don't go into it. Part of the reason is because of outsourcing. Part of it is because of the H-1B program. They feel that the government is actually working against their profession.
But you talk about
they're not going to recommend that.
But talk about disentangling. Are you then saying if we slam the door on foreign talent or keep the cap tight and low, that somehow we're going to have a burst of American students suddenly in math and science and on the leading edge? Is there really going to be a cause and effect like that?
No. What I'm saying is that we need to improve the H-1B program so that we can improve the working conditions. And rather than having companies be able to pay below market wages, why not have them pay market wages?
I thought we heard from Robert Hoffman at Oracle, prevailing wage is the law.
That's right, and that's the legalese that's used. Prevailing wage is a term of art. It's not an actual market wage. And we know it's not a market wage because employers have told the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, that they sometimes hire H-1Bs because they're willing to take below market wages and still comply with that prevailing wage, that term of art law. And we see this with the median wage. I just gave you the median wage for H-1B workers in fiscal year 2005 was $50,000. That means that half of those 52,000 people that came in are being paid below entry-level wages, not even median wage, which is closer to $75,000.
We'll look at how
so they're being paid significantly lower.
We'll look at how the law might be tweaked here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me get a call from Dasha in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dasha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Dasha?
Well, I'm one of those unfortunate H-1B visa applicants.
Why unfortunate, Dasha? We thought that the world was golden for them.
Well, I'm not an IT professional. I don't have any high-tech skills. I'm a social scientist.
Okay.
And the problem for people like me, for, you know, individual little people who have one boss who really wants them, is that the application process is completely flooded with IT applications, many of which are just then being contracted out again. They're not one individual person applying for one individual job. Rather, it's a company that applies for 12,000 positions and then contracts them out to
Microsoft.
So
does the United States feel friendly and inviting to a visa applicant like you?
Well, not right now, I have to say. I mean, I lived here for 10 years now, paid taxes, and it's my second home, and I really want to live and work here, but my life will be decided by a lottery, and it just doesn't... I want to be evaluated on the basis of merit because I know what I have to offer, and it's just a little bit insulting, I have to confess.
Right, but a lottery is kind of a strange way. Dasha, let us pick that up. Ron, let me come to you. If you could change the law, there's a lot of proposals out there, tightening up from Grassley and Durbin, maybe loosening up from Guterres and Flake. How would you change this law, Ron, to make it better?
Sure. I think there's really three big flaws in the H-1B program that need to be fixed. The first is to have a labor market test. What that means is that companies should have demonstrated that they've looked for American workers before hiring an H-1B. In fact, they don't have to do that now.
Right.
And that to ensure that the foreign workers are not exploited, they should be paid on the H-1B market wages, not this legally constructed prevailing wage.
Okay.
And the third piece is to actually have some oversight. So we've got pages of regulations on the H-1B, but there's no oversight. There's no accountability. There's no organization that's ensuring that companies are actually complying by the regulations.
To see how these workers are being used. What about the lottery face of this? Should we be assessing one by one? Does the lottery make sense?
No, I don't know if the lottery makes sense. I mean, in fact, you know, the problem here is that there's no transparency and not enough transparency in the program. And if you fix the program, you would take away a lot of the objections to the program. So I don't think the lottery makes much sense. And I'm very sympathetic with the caller, and including my own foreign graduate students who are also trying to find jobs, and my wife who also is a professor and has foreign graduate students.
And what about the absolute number, 65,000 now? Would you like to see it go to 115,000, 180,000?
I want to see the program fixed. I don't think we know how many are being used in what way.
Lynn Shotwell, how about it? Are you up for the kind of fixes Ron's talking about? Is your organization ready to, you know, tighten it up, make it more logical?
I think the labor market test that he's talking about, that's what we do now with the green card system. So we need to streamline that system so that we can get people directly from a student status or from overseas onto a green card in a very efficient manner. And then that will take the pressure off of the H-1B visas, and we may not need as many. In terms of market wages, Ron knows that currently H-1B workers can change employers. They have the ability to take that H-1B and go to a different employer. So if they're being underpaid, they can change that situation by moving to a different employer. And certainly we agree, you know, that we should enforce the current laws, and the Department of Labor should conduct oversight to ensure that everybody's competing fairly.
So there's a glimpse of another very hot end of the immigration story, all tied up with American competitiveness and American jobs. Lynn Shotwell, thanks for your insights today. We appreciate your being with us from Washington. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you. And Ron Hira at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Ron, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.